Full Story is supported by Telstra. Big ambitions need the right partner, and that's where Telstra comes in. Telstra works with enterprise and government organisations across Australia to help them build, connect, and grow at scale. They support real outcomes, from secure business growth to connecting schools to networks that help keep communities safe. Telstra is a long-term partner for organisations with complex needs and big plans. Together builds better, wherever they go. For enterprise-sized solutions, partner with Telstra.
Tori, Dan, it's great to have you back on Full Story.
Hi, Anur.
Pleasure to be here.
Before the results of the South Australian election came in, both of you had been writing about the potential of an orange wave. Polling for months has indicated that support for One Nation was surging, and that's now been reflected at the ballot box. What did you feel in your gut as you saw this pretty tectonic moment in Australian politics play out?
Well, the silver lining was that the polls were right, so I guess it wasn't such a big surprise, although I had thought people might turn shy once they got into the booth and had a look at that ballot paper. Look, in my gut, I just thought it's an existential crisis for the Liberal Party, but it's also such a shift in how we have to think about politics from here on in. And then my second thought was, but hold on, they always fall apart, don't they? One Nation. I mean, we have had one Nation person, MLC, elected here before, Sarah Game, and she didn't last too long before she left the party. Pauline Hanson has a long history of falling out with the candidates that she gets installed in parliaments around the country. So obviously One Nation is extremely happy right now, but it could all come crumbling down.
Dan?
Yeah, it's, I mean, as you said, this is what the polls had predicted. This is in some ways what played out on Saturday night was expected. They probably did a bit better than what all of us thought. But there was still that sense of expectation ahead of Saturday night because, I mean, listeners in South Australia will remember the experience of Nick Xenophon in 2018 where he was surging in the polls early in the year. And by the time it reached election day, it just fell apart completely. You didn't win a seat in the lower house. But to see it actually play out, for it to eventuate on the night, to see those images, I was covering it from Canberra, and to see, you know, a room full of orange, to see Pauline Hanson and Corey Bernardi, you know, being hailed as they walked into the room. It did really feel like a significant moment in Australian politics, as though something we've sensed for months, really since the end of the federal election in 2025, that something was happening, something was changing. And I think that we can here and now say that something has changed. What the implications are here on out, we'll just have to wait and see. But something in our politics has changed.
I wonder if it's something like a critical mass thing, you know, enough people make it acceptable to vote One Nation, and people who otherwise would have been put off by the stigma of the party as being predominantly, you know, promoting some pretty racist rhetoric. Maybe that's had a strange little effect as well that could continue.
Before we talk about the implications of this result, Tori, for anyone watching the ABC's coverage, they would have known that the national broadcaster's cameras were barred from going inside One Nation's election night party. You were there. Can you tell us what you saw and what you heard?
Well, the first thing I saw and heard was a burly bloke trying to block me from getting in, yelling at me that I was the ABC. He said several times, "You're the ABC," but with expletives that I have now left out. And then somebody I knew in my previous life at the Advertiser went past and went, "Oh, no, mate, she's News Corp." And he went, "Come on in," which is quite funny. And then a little bit later, James Ashby, who's, you know, Pauline Hanson's right-hand man, was sort of doing an audit, like, "Where are you from? Where are you from?" And he went, "Oh, The Guardian.
How'd you get in?
Let you in?" Again, with an expletive. So, yeah, it's pretty belligerent obnoxiousness there. And yeah, the poor ABC waiting outside. That's been consistent on ABC radio here in South Australia as well, that, you know, they've done lots of coverage of the state election. They've had the Premier on multiple times, opposition leader Ashton Hearn on multiple times, and every time they said, and we did ask One Nation, but One Nation do not like answering questions.
Dan, for people who don't follow politics closely, the results of this election may be a confusing one. Mm. As of recording, One Nation has picked up one lower house seat in SA, but it's secured an unprecedented primary vote, and that's been the focus of a lot of coverage. Where do things stand at the moment? Can you explain this vote for us?
Yeah, I think people are getting an insight into how our voting system works, particularly the preferential voting system. And as we talk about what are the things that could sort of stem or resist the tide of populism here, it could end up being our preferential voting system. So as you said, One Nation, I just checked the latest numbers before I came on, were polling their primary vote at about 22%, which is ahead of the Liberal Party, which is an extraordinary number. But of course, that vote is different in all across the state. So they performed, One Nation performed incredibly well in certain regional seats. They performed quite well in outer suburban Labor held seats, but less well in the inner cities. So in terms of the way that translates into winning seats, for an outsider, someone that's not in the major parties to be able to win, they're reliant on a strong flow of preferences from others. And One Nation, I think that was always one of the narratives going into this, that they would struggle, that people, you know, there were a large group of people that would be very supportive of One Nation, but a large group that just didn't want anything to do with them. So look, I think best case scenario here is they possibly win 4 seats in the lower house. They potentially win 3 seats in the upper house. So they have 7 members in parliament, which is extraordinary. But it does highlight one of the challenges that they're going to face as we sort of extrapolate this to what it could mean in different parts of the country, that preferences and One Nation's potential, the challenge they have in getting preferences, that could be the thing that holds them back, that stops them, that prevents them from going kind of winning 1 or 2 seats to really becoming a legitimate opposition party.
Mm. What does it tell us that they've been able to secure 20%+ of the primary vote with little to no policy substance, Tory?
The policy question was asked so many times and it just never seemed to cut through. There was an advertiser YouGov poll that said more than half of people planning to vote for One Nation were doing it basically as an FU to the major parties, and only 10% were voting for them for their policies. Mm. So it's a protest vote, as much as Pauline Hanson doesn't want to recognise that. As I moved around the, you know, election night party for One Nation on Saturday night, I asked a bunch of people, and a lot of people sort of vaguely said, oh, I don't like multiculturalism, or I like their anti-immigration. You know, they pulled on federal One Nation policies, mm-hmm. and there was nothing in there for the states. And at one point, I think in response to criticism from Premier Peter Malinauskas that they didn't have any South Australian policies, they put out an email and said, look, here's our website, which has federal policies on it. So, yeah, look, only 1 in 10 One Nation voters cared about the policies.
And I think that points to what is the driving force behind, in this case, One Nation voters, is they essentially went into the ballot box and just hit the detonate button, that they just want to level the system as it stands. They, you know, there was clearly a protest against the Liberal Party, but there was also one against the Labor Party. And it wasn't really a frustration about a particular policy area. They weren't motivated by wanting to implement a particular policy because, as Tory said, I mean, they had a website, they had subheads, they talked about education, immigration, energy policy, but those policies weren't really policies. They were motherhood statements. So the thing that was motivating people is they just wanted, they wanted change, but not in the traditional sense that we talk about change in politics, whereas if a Liberal government is in power, you know, this vote for change to get Labor in, this was more fundamental change. I don't like the system. I want it gone, and I'm prepared to accept a party that, you know, based on what we've seen, is clearly incapable, doesn't have a plan to govern. But it was just the fact that they were so different to the others that that was what was attractive.
Mm. Dan, before we talk about the implications for Labor federally, you've written that this is a microcosm of the predicament that the Liberals face. Do you think the federal Liberals have a solution to get themselves out of that predicament?
In a word, no. at this stage, because it's, I mean, I've written this a few times, is what we've seen now, and there is verifiable proof in terms of what happened in South Australia, is they're facing an existential crisis in the regions. They're almost unelectable in the cities. So where do they fit? Who is their natural constituency now? I think, I mean, I was sent to South Australia the week before the election with the task of going out and speaking to One Nation voters. I mean, perhaps the task in the future is going to be go out and find a Liberal voter, because it's becoming increasingly hard to find who are those people that believe in what the Liberal Party is offering. So look, there is going to be a debate, and it's already started again. We had Liberals that were on the election night panels that were doing the coverage, already talking about, you know, Tony Passon, the Conservative Liberal MP, talking about we need to go to the right. There'll be others saying that we need to be more centrist. But I think, and perhaps we'll get to this later on, is the solution for both the Liberal Party and the Labor Party to combating populism, and the thing that is motivating it, is develop and demonstrate that you can implement policies that are actually going to make people's lives easier. That might end up being the solution to all this.
I can't believe people say the answer is to go further right. And I can't remember who said it, but you can't out Pauline. You know, it's just everything has shown they need to, if they ever want to govern again, it's the centre that they need to take back. It's just, before this result, I sort of thought, you know, if One Nation really do translate these polls at the ballot box, it'll be mere seconds before someone says, we've got to go further right.
And it happened. And you can, I mean, Tori, you've worked in Canberra before. You can just predict how the week is going to play out. When the Liberal Party room meets on Tuesday morning, there will be people coming forward with exactly that views. And it is irreconcilable, but I suppose it speaks to the problem that they face, is they just don't know where to go.
The broad church has kind of got an uncrossable divide between the two sides of pews.
Dan, I want to pick up on that point you've just made, because Barnaby Joyce said that they're coming for Labor. If the surge in support for One Nation is fueled by anger and frustration over economic insecurity, distrust in the establishment, we are now hurtling towards a path where those things may only get worse, with the impact of the war on Iran being compared to COVID and the GFC. Do you think that Labor, that the federal government, is willing to take on the kind of economic and social reforms that many say are necessary to curtail the rise of the populist right?
It's a really interesting question, Noor, and it's something that I've been reflecting on quite a lot over the past sort of 48, 72 hours, in that, you know, we've thought for a long time, the sort of intuitive thinking was that Labor would be pushed to adopt progressive reform or structural reform to the economy from its left flank, whether it was the Greens, whether it was Teal Independence, whether it was MPs within Labor or the Labor movement more generally, that was going to be the things that would be required for it to really make quite fundamental changes to housing policy or economic policy or tax policy. But I'm wondering if the trigger might ultimately be right-wing populism. It is the threat of right-wing populism, in this case in the form of One Nation, that prompts Labor to say, look, we need to really do things differently. And the sense I got when I was in South Australia is that if you pare back what is driving this desire for change, if you really drill down, it goes deeper, I think, than a concern about immigration. It's a sense of, and the Labor Premier Peter Malinauskas, I think, has articulated this better than anyone, this feeling of lost opportunity, a sense that they've been left behind by certain things. And the housing crisis is the best encapsulation of it. It is a policy. It's a policy issue where a large segment of the population just can't break in. So I wonder whether, and we're about to have a federal budget in May, and there's talk of changes to the capital gains tax and negative gearing, that the thing that motivates the government to ultimately do that mightn't be to appease its progressive flank or to adopt progressive reform in the way that we've thought, but rather to fix the root cause of what's driving populism in this country.
Tori, I wonder what you think about the way that both Peter Malinauskas and Anthony Albanese have responded to the results. You know, we've heard Malinauskas talking about patriotism being co-opted by one political ideology. Anthony Albanese is urging vigilance against those wanting to turn back the clock. For people around the country who may be inclined to support One Nation, how do you think that kind of language will land?
Look, I think Peter Malinauskas particularly he picked the way to deal with One Nation and their supporters early on and did a really good job of it, which is that you've got to recognise the grievances that these people have. I would argue that, you know, One Nation makes people feel like things are worse than they are, only to then capitalise on that exacerbated sense of grievance.
Yeah.
So distinguish the supporters from the party itself. Mm. And so he consistently happy to take a whack at Pauline Hanson. I get what you're saying. Things are rough at the moment. But this woman is not the one with the policies to help you out at all. And I thought the patriotism stuff was pretty interesting. I mean, that did seem to be allowing One Nation to influence how he's talking about things. Mm. But I also think it'll find a willing audience. I mean, after things like the March for Australia, you know, where you had Nazis mingling in with people who wanted to wave the flag, it's going to be a tricky line to distinguish between, you know, whether someone's waving it because they're anti-Semitic and, well, anti-Islam and anti-women and anti-all sorts of things, or whether because they're just, you know, proud of the nation. But, yeah, look, I'm sure that will be received positively in some circles.
And I think there's, you know, I think we've reached a point now where both Anthony Albanese federally and Malinauskas at a state level, they have to acknowledge it. They have to respond to it. Perhaps 6 months ago, there was a debate about, do we ignore it? Do we want to give oxygen to it? Do we actively try and respond? I think it's clear now that there's an issue that needs to be dealt with. And when we get to kind of federal implications, one of the big questions for the Albanese government is Peter Malinauskas is a brilliant political communicator. Can Albanese replicate that? Can he speak with the nuance? Can he draw those distinctions that Tory spoke about in terms of separating the party from the voters? And it's all, you know, it's all fascinating to see.
Do you think he can, Dan?
Look, I think the kindest way to say is that Anthony Albanese is not on the same level as Peter Malinauskas as a political communicator, and perhaps sometimes we put too much stock in communication and public messaging. But I think in this particular type of issue, I think it's really important. And I think Albanese is going to really lean heavily on, I mean, one thing he does have going in his favour is a very large group of senior ministers who are good communicators. So perhaps I'm sure he would have spoken to Malinauskas or sent him a text message on Saturday night, and perhaps there's, you know, they'll sit down and work it out. But I think Malinauskas has set the template there. Now, whether other politicians are capable of replicating it, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Can I just add to that as well? You know, adding to the challenges of how do you solve a problem like Pauline is, of course, disinformation and misinformation online, and most people getting their news from social media. And no matter how good a communicator Malinauskas or Albanese is, they're competing with a severe flow of counter information.
Mm. We'll be right back. In recent weeks, Pauline Hanson has made Islamophobic claims like there are no good Muslims in Australia. Barnaby Joyce has said that his party doesn't believe in multiculturalism. On election night, he also made a grossly offensive and dehumanising comment comparing Muslim immigrants to cattle. Rhetoric like that has been increasingly mainstreamed by far-right populist leaders around the world, like Donald Trump. Should we be bracing for yet more culture wars, more racism, more Islamophobia, and are political leaders capable or equipped to push back on it?
I think it's here. Mm. I've been having a look at this sort of ecosystem from, you know, the real dark depths of the internet to the broadcasters, to the, you know, all the people who are then having a lot of the right-wing politicians on their shows and discussing a lot of these things. And there's this kind of this funnel of that awful rhetoric from those dark corners of the internet, and it kind of gets legitimized. You know, you can sort of almost predict that that phrase, like take mass immigration, for example. You know, you hear it in the US, you hear it in the UK, you hear it starting on the internet here, and then next thing you know, you hear it in Parliament. So, yeah, I think it's already happening. And I mean, if I had any answers about how you stop it, I'd be, I don't know, doing a different job.
Yeah, I think Tori's absolutely right. It's already here, and results like what we saw on Saturday night, you only need to see the way that, I mean, Barnaby Joyce was on TV this morning crowing about the result. You can see they're emboldened. And I think it's, you know, the reality is for people that voted One Nation, they might have had a whole series of motivations, but by supporting One Nation, there is that tacit approval for the worst elements of what Pauline Hanson demonstrates. And I think we can expect that Barnaby Joyce, Hanson and the other One Nation senators will take that vote as an endorsement of their whole package. And I think it will be interesting to see, because there is, I think there is going to be a line, even for people that are so aggrieved that want to fundamentally change the system, that there might be a point at which they say, I just cannot support the things that Barnaby Joyce and Pauline Hanson are saying. So I think it'll be an interesting test of how far they're prepared to go. And of course, we're going to see, you know, there's electoral tests coming up right throughout the year, the Farrer by-election in May, and then the Victorian state election in November. And you can expect that as the results come from all of that, the different parties will respond to the messages they receive.
Corey Bernardi got away with kind of doubling down on his comments leaking bestiality to homosexuality with barely a blip.
Yeah.
It's like Trump, you know, you keep thinking that the line's been crossed, which maybe it has now, but, you know, at various points you sort of thought surely no one can vote for him after, you know, grab him by the pussy, and then people kept going far further than I would have thought they would.
It's often said that, you know, One Nation gets a free pass, or Pauline Hanson gets a free pass in the Australian media. Will this change the way that media reports on One Nation, that it will lead to greater scrutiny because the party can't be dismissed as a fringe party anymore?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think now that we've got sitting members in South Australia without any policy, surely that will bring more scrutiny. By the way, I was also shocked to hear State President Carlos Crumbera thank some elements of the media for how well One Nation did. So he thanked Sky News. He also thanked Channel 9 and Channel 7. They'd had a great big whack at the ABC, which again just shows you how unwilling they are to kind of face any sort of scrutiny.
Yeah, and I think the scrutiny will also come from, or the increased scrutiny we'll see from the other political parties. And I think what we're going to see, particularly from the coalition, who face the bigger threat from One Nation at this stage, is they are going to be more assertive in pushing back against One Nation's policies and things like having net zero immigration, pointing out the challenges that that would quite clearly place on being able to build the homes needed to address the housing crisis, for instance. So I think we're going to see more scrutiny of One Nation's language and policies, but of course that creates the risk of legitimizing it. And also I think Pauline Hanson, and there was an element of this in her victory speech on Saturday night, is framing herself as almost the victim, that she'd been in Parliament for 30 years and she'd been stepped on and she was an outsider and this result had vindicated her. Is what One Nation loves more than anything is being ganged up upon by the major parties. These censure motions that we see in the Senate, for instance, where Pauline Hanson is quote unquote silenced by the Senate. Pauline Hanson loves that because it reinforces that distinction between what One Nation describes as the uni party and this party of the outsiders. So yes, I think there's going to be more scrutiny. That's legitimate. We need to do it. But also we need to be prepared for One Nation to, for how they respond to that scrutiny, and almost invite it as a way of communicating with their voters that, look, the mainstream media and the major parties, they're out to get us.
It's almost that Trump tactic. Dan, Tori, a really fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That was Chief Political Correspondent Dan Jervis-Bardi and Senior Reporter Tori Shepherd. You can find more of their work on theguardian.com, and we've linked to their latest pieces on the SA election on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert. Sound design and mixing by Joe Koning. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. And if you like this episode, don't forget you can subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. And please leave us a review. I'm Noor Haidar. Thanks for listening.